Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
Majed Jamil is overloaded. As a teacher in the West Bank, he is used to pressure. Recently, clashes between students and Israeli soldiers resulted in clouds of tear gas floating into his school's playground in Hebron. But Jamil could deal with that. The event was not unusual. It was a kind of pressure he understood. But his current situation is different. Jamil has seen his classes almost double in size since the U.S. cut funding to the United Nations Relief and Work Agency last year. His once well-controlled social studies class at the Hebron Boys School has become crowded and wild. Four children now share desks made for two. Hands are raised at the same time. Noise spreads through the classroom when he stops for questions. Jamil says, "You spend most of the class time restraining student interactions or fights and have no time left to track their homework and classwork or give one-on-one help."
The U.S. aid cuts have affected all of UNRWA's operations. But it has done the greatest harm to the school system serving 500,000 children across the Middle East. Without money, the agency says it cannot accept more students, add new teachers, or expand the classrooms. Peter Mulrain is with UNRWA's New York office. He said average class sizes in the West Bank have grown from 30 students a year ago to 50. And Jamil feels it. "There's a huge difference between correcting exams for 27 students and for 47 students," he said. "I just want things to go back to how they were last year."
Students, too, say they have felt the change. "It's been really hard for me to understand what's going on in class this year," said Suhail Jaber, a ninth grader at the Hebron School. "If the teacher stops to explain things when we're confused, I feel class is suddenly over, and I won't ever understand." 10-year-old Ali Azazme said he has stopped even trying. "With all the heads in front of me, I can't see the board anyway," he said. The U.S. was UNRWA's biggest donor for many years. In early 2018, the U.S. reduced the amount of aid from $360 million to $60 million. In 2019, it went down to zero.
UNRWA was established following the 1948 war surrounding Israel's creation. Its aim was to aid the estimated 700,000 Palestinians who fled or were forced from their homes in the fighting. Today, the agency serves about 5 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, as well as Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. It provides services that local governments do not. In a recent speech to the UN Security Council, U.S. Mideast diplomat Jason Greenblatt said the UNRWA model has failed the Palestinian people. He said, "The UNRWA model cannot provide to Palestinians what they deserve, a life where they can plan for their future and the future of their children, and one where they know whether schools and health clinics will remain open." He called for host governments and other aid organizations to meet the need. Critics in the U.S. and Israel have accused the agency of keeping the Israeli-Palestinian conflict alive. They also say UNRWA supports a culture of welfare dependency. Instead of working to resettle the refugees, they say UNRWA permits refugee status to be passed down for generations, even when refugees have gained citizenship in some countries, such as Jordan.
UNRWA rejects the criticism, pointing out that refugees in other conflicts also keep their status. It says it is carrying out a UN order that represents the will of the international community. The best way to solve the Palestinian refugee problem, it says, is to find a political answer that speaks to their future. After the U.S. cuts, European and Persian Gulf countries gave $1.2 billion to keep the schools as well as health and food aid centers open. Mulrain said, "When you hear that we've maintained our programs and reduced our deficit, what you don't see is that the quality of our services is under threat."
Palestinians view UNRWA as support for their demand that refugees have the right of return to their homes in what is now Israel. Israel rejects the demand. After the U.S. recognized the disputed city of Jerusalem as Israel's capital in December 2017, the Palestinians cut ties with President Donald Trump's administration. Palestinians believe the cuts to UNRWA, along with an end to hundreds of millions of dollars in other aid, are part of a broader U.S. effort to add pressure.
Later this month, the U.S. is to present its long-awaited Mideast peace plan at an economic conference in Bahrain. The aim is to raise money from wealthy Arab nations and others for investment in the Palestinian territories. However, Palestinian politicians have said they will not lose hope of establishing a nation in exchange for economic investment. Without an answer to the problem, Mulrain said, millions of Palestinians are suffering. He added, it's the most vulnerable people who pay the price. I'm Katie Weaver.
Apple has announced new software and privacy tools as it seeks to expand service offerings to its estimated 1.4 billion device users. The announcements came during Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference happening this week in San Jose, California. The changes are another clear sign of Apple's attempts to expand its offerings to make up for dropping iPhone demand worldwide. iPhone sales fell sharply during the past two financial quarters. For iPhone users, Apple announced the launch of its iOS 13 operating system to be available this fall. The new version comes with several new features. One is a setting for the iPhone called Dark Mode. The feature, already available on Mac computers, turns the background of the device black. Apple says Dark Mode is designed to make everything on the screen easier on the eyes. It can be used all the time or set to come on at a specific time. iOS 13 also offers iPhone users a way to avoid using sign-in services of Facebook and Google when using apps. Instead, users can sign in with their Apple ID. Apple says the feature aims to respect the privacy of users by not collecting tracking information through the apps or services. Facebook and Google collect such user information for its advertising business. In addition, iOS 13 includes a redesigned Maps app that provides more detail about the world around you. It has a feature that lets users look at actual street photos and move through streets within the app. The feature is very similar to Google's Street View, which has been available for years. The new iPhone OS also adds improvements to Apple's Siri personal assistant system. The company says the new Siri has a more natural voice and will work with map and music apps. Apple announced the iPad will get its own operating system to replace the existing one made for iPhones. The new OS is designed to make it easier for iPad users to use the device to do more of the things a laptop computer can do. Apple also introduced several new apps for its Apple Watch device to be included with the new Watch OS 6 system. Among these are apps that operate independently without the need to be linked to a user's iPhone. The smartwatch's Health app is also adding new features to record more exercise information, monitor safe hearing levels, and track women's menstrual cycles. In addition, the App Store will now be available on Apple Watch, making it possible for people to find and download apps directly to the device. In its laptop and desktop businesses, Apple announced it is breaking up its longtime digital music software, iTunes. Later this year, the software will be split into three apps: Apple Music, Apple Podcasts, and Apple TV. Apple has already reduced the importance of iTunes on the iPhone and iPad and will now do the same on Mac computers, too. iTunes will still be available on Macs using older OS versions, as well as on machines running Microsoft's Windows system. Apple also used its developers' conference to show off a new Mac Pro high-performance desktop computer to go on sale this fall. The machine, which Apple describes as extreme in every way, is designed for professional users. Pricing for the low-end model Mac Pro starts at $5,000. $999. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Britain was once the most powerful nation in the world. It ruled a far-reaching empire. We look at how British power gave way to American influence after World War II. One can almost name the day when this happened. It was February 21st, 1947. British diplomats in Washington called the State Department. They had two messages from their government. The first was about Greece. The situation there was critical. Greece had been occupied by Germany during the war. Now it was split by a bitter civil war. On one side of the fighting was the Greek royal family, supported by Britain. On the other side were communist-led rebels, supported by Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union. British forces had helped keep Greece from becoming communist at the end of World War II. A few years later, Britain could no longer help. It needed all its strength to rebuild after the war. So on that February day in 1947, Britain told the United States it would soon end all support for Greece. Britain's second message that day was about Turkey. Turkey was stronger than Greece, but the concern was that it too could become communist unless it received outside help. Britain warned the United States that the Soviet Union would soon extend its control all the way across Eastern Europe to the Eastern Mediterranean. It called on President Harry Truman to provide strong American support to help Greece and Turkey resist the communist threat. Britain, in effect, was asking the United States to take over leadership of the Western world. The United States was ready to accept this new responsibility. For months, relations between the United States and the Soviet Union had been growing worse and worse. The two countries had fought together as allies in the Second World War. But Soviet actions after the war shocked the American people. The Soviet Union wanted to block Western political and economic influence in Central and Eastern Europe. It wanted to extend its own influence instead. So after the war, it forced a number of countries to establish communist governments.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
Britain's Prime Minister Winston Churchill described the situation in a speech in March of 1946 at Westminster College in the American state of Missouri.
Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow.
Churchill warned that the Soviet Union was trying to expand its power. He described it as an iron curtain falling across the middle of Europe. This iron curtain divided Europe into a communist East and a democratic West. The situation was made even more tense by news coming from China. China was a divided nation at the end of World War II. The forces of nationalist leader Chiang Kai-shek controlled the southwestern part of the country. Communist forces under Mao Zedong controlled the north. Both the United States and the Soviet Union expected that Chiang Kai-shek would be able to unite China. Chiang and the Nationalists won several early victories over the Communists, but Mao and his forces used a growing hatred of the Nationalist government to win support. Slowly, they began to win battles and capture arms. Early in 1949, Communist forces took control of Peking, now Beijing, and Tianjin. They captured Shanghai and Canton. By the end of the year, Chiang and his nationalist forces had to flee to the island of Taiwan. The fall of the nationalist government on the mainland caused a bitter political debate in America. Some critics of the Truman administration thought the United States had not done enough to help the Nationalists. The Truman administration rejected the charges. It said Chiang caused his own defeat by failing to reform and win the support of the Chinese people. Secretary of State Dean Acheson described the defeat this way: "The unfortunate but inescapable fact is that the ominous result of the civil war in China was beyond the control of the government of the United States. Nothing that this country did or could have done within the reasonable limits of its capabilities could have changed that result. Nothing that was left undone by this country has contributed to it. It was the product of internal Chinese forces, forces which this country tried to influence but could not. A decision was arrived at within China, if only a decision by default." The United States was more successful in its policies toward Europe. The British warnings about the communist threat in Greece and Turkey led President Truman to speak to Congress. He said, "I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures." Truman called on Congress to give him $400 million in aid for Greece and Turkey. After a brief but intense national debate, Congress agreed. Truman then launched an effort to save the Greek economy and reorganize the Greek army. Soon after that, Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union ended their aid to Greek rebels. The civil war in Greece ended. American help for Greece and Turkey was the first step in what became known as the Truman Doctrine. The goal of this policy was to stop Soviet aggression anywhere in the world. Truman was willing to use military force to stop the spread of communism, but he also believed it was equally important to build up Western European nations so they would be strong enough to defend themselves. Europe was suffering terribly after World War II. There were severe shortages of food and fuel. Crops were destroyed. Many Europeans were beginning to look to the communists, to anybody, to save them. This is one reason why Truman and his advisors developed a plan to rebuild the economies of Europe. After the war, President Truman made George Marshall his Secretary of State. Marshall had led American troops as a general in World War II. Now, as the nation's top diplomat, he proposed the idea for rebuilding Europe. This idea became known as the Marshall Plan. President Truman explained why there had to be a Marshall Plan. People were starving, he said. There had been food riots in France and Italy. There was not enough fuel. People were cold and sick. Tuberculosis was breaking out. As Truman said later, something had to be done. Secretary of State Marshall described the plan during a congressional hearing in Washington.
Why must the United States carry so great a load in helping Europe? The answer is simple. The United States is the only country in the world today which has the economic power and productivity to furnish the needed assistance. The 6 8/10 billion proposed for the first 15 months is less than a single month's charge of the war. To be quite clear, this unprecedented endeavor of the new world to help the old is neither sure nor easy. It is a calculated risk. It is a difficult program. And you know far better than I do the political difficulties involved in this program. But there's no doubt whatever in my mind that if we decide to do this thing, we can do it successfully. And there's also no doubt in my mind that the whole world hangs in the balance as to what it is to be.
The United States offered aid through the Marshall Plan to all countries in Europe. The Soviet Union and its allies refused help. 16 other countries, however, welcomed the aid. From 1948 to 1952, administrators of the Marshall Plan worked with these countries. The United States spent $13 billion. The plan worked. Agricultural production in Marshall Plan countries increased by 10%. Industrial production increased by 35%. Production in some industries, such as steel, increased by much more. There were political results as well. Stronger economies helped prevent communists from gaining control of the governments in France and Italy. Some Europeans criticized the Marshall Plan. They said it increased tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union in the years after the war. Yet few could deny that the plan was one of the most successful international economic programs in history.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.